2012, March 5th. Today is Astronomy 141, Lecture 40, SETI, the Search for Extraterrestrial Intelligence. This week is the last week of class. It's hard to believe it, but we are actually on, this is Lecture 40. And we are now in the last portions of Astronomy 141. We started on January 3rd, and now here we are on March 5th. And I like to say that this week is the payoff. This is the where we start asking the questions that probably led most people, including myself, to be interested in this class. Are we alone in the universe? And that's the theme of this week's class. And today, what we're going to do is start that by talking about actual efforts that we have begun to make to actually search for extraterrestrial intelligence, a process that is referred to by its initials as SETI. So we're going to be talking today about the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. And what SETI comes down to is searching primarily for artificial radio signals that may be the best way to look for artificial intelligence elsewhere in the universe. And we'll see what the reasons are for that. Why radio wavelengths? There are a couple of other options using optical and infrared lasers, but those haven't caught on quite as much as what I'd call radio SETI. Turns out that one of the reasons why radio SETI is so useful is there's some very natural frequency bands that occur where you could send signals that would not be confused with actual natural signals. So it's a way of how do you craft a signal so you don't look like something that may be made by nature itself. And there are lots of sources of radio radiation in the universe. So you want to look artificial. And you want to look someplace where other people might be looking. And those places are dictated by basic physics. So an intelligent civilization that understands something about the nature of atomic matter and can study the universe would actually think, oh yeah, this is kind of a unique place to go looking. It's an obvious sort of street lamp. The old joke about a drunk looking for his car keys, he's looking at night underneath a street lamp. And the guy says, why are you looking, where'd you lose your keys? Well, over there. So why are you looking at the street lamp? Because the light's better here. This is one of those, the light's better there. It's an obvious place to look. We're going to look at some of the strategies that people are doing. There are two basic classes of SETI strategies, targeted and piggyback searches that are underway at a number of telescopes. I'll give two major examples of efforts that are underway, but there are lots of groups doing this. There are more than we'll talk about. And finally, in addition to listening, we have also been actively sending messages into space. Your homework problem is one example of a way of doing that. Some of those radio waves are intentional and some of them are quite unintentional. For example, the fact that we've been on the air for the last century with open radio broadcasts, and that's going to have something that someone could easily pick up. We've also sent out human artifacts on some of the spacecraft that are now on their way out of our solar system. They're not directed anywhere in particular, but they're examples of the kind of ways in which we might leave our marks, if you will, on these artifacts of human intelligence that might be picked up in the distant future by someone scouring the galaxy like ourselves for signs of other intelligence. So this is where we're going today. We're going to talk about SETI, how we're going to actually actively search. The big question, the number one question that I get asked or that we're really addressing with this class is there intelligent life elsewhere in the universe? Are we alone? What do we mean by intelligent life? Well, we've defined that as we're looking for highly advanced technological civilizations. Civilizations that possess the technology that are capable of communicating across interstellar distances. They might even be capable of starflight, although as we'll talk later this week, that has certain issues to it. But furthermore, not only are they capable of communicating, but they are interested in communicating and interested in finding other intelligences with whom they might communicate, might have a conversation. Although that conversation might be low and sort of slow because of the great distances involved, nonetheless, they have to care. A planet full of Zen monks might not care. An ocean world full of dolphins may not have the ability to develop a higher technology, even though they may have extreme intelligence, even more intelligence if you could measure such a thing, than us. And of course, what I've illustrated here is the Drake equation that we talked about on Thursday, is a way of estimating the number of civilizations that might be present in our galaxy at this very instant. So averaged over the lifetime of a galaxy, this would be much, much larger. But civilizations can only live a short period of time. So you punch in the typical numbers for this, and as we did last time, very optimistic numbers of this, including a few pessimistic numbers like civilizations only last 100 years, just thrown in for keep things honest. We came up with, at any given instant, among the 200 billion stars of our galaxy, there may be of order 50 communicating civilizations out there that we could speak with. Now, this is a very optimistic estimate because we're giving a lot of credit to once life emerges that intelligence is an inevitable outcome of that. But that's not always possibly the case, as we'll discuss later on. So these are kind of the odds, and the odds are pretty small. How do we go about doing this search? Well, one of those ways is a way, in fact, that we've been exploring in the previous weeks, and that is to go out and look for possible places where these extraterrestrials might be living. And we've decided to define that, since we don't have any other obvious basis to start with than our own experience, let's go out and find Earth-like planets inside the habitable zones of their stars, places where there is stable liquid water on the surface, where we try to first find those planets. This is a process which is going on today. We haven't gotten there yet, but we're really close. And then once we find such exo-Earths, the technologically even more challenging problem is of measuring those planets and looking for things like spectroscopic biomarkers in the reflection and emission spectra of those planets. That's kind of the goal. This is actually a fairly well-defined goal. But of course, this would help us detect biomarkers similar to life on Earth, and it might actually be a pretty reasonable thing to do, but it doesn't necessarily detect intelligent life. It just simply shows us that the conditions conducive to life appear to be present on this world. After all, terrible thing to think about, but imagine sort of, you know, a zombie apocalypse or some kind of plague wipes out all human beings, in fact, all mammalian life on this planet. Our atmosphere would still look like this. There was life there. It takes a while for the biomarkers to go away. So it's not 100% guaranteed that the life is intelligent. We may be reduced to cats and dogs, but still, we have something to look for. And it's a well-defined thing to look for. We've defined criteria. This helps us now design experiments, design observing experiments to do this. But there are other people who are much less patient with that. They want to go right after the hard stuff. So another approach has been to assume that intelligent life actually exists, that is technologically capable and common, and to start searching directly for electromagnetic signals coming from them. Now, this assumes implicitly that all civilizations that develop beyond a certain level of technology want to communicate, want to make their presence known. And it kind of skips over all the hard stuff, like, you know, going out and finding those Earth mass planets or developing star flight capability, and kind of just tries to go straight for the ultimate answer. In some sense, it's not a bad strategy. If you find something, that's huge. The problem is not if you find something. The problem is what happens if this approach doesn't find anything. Then the reasons for that failure will probably be rather elusive. We don't know why we failed. Is it because we are alone in our galaxy? We're it? That there is life, but none of it is intelligent except us? Is it possible that intelligence develops without technology? Often. And so technology like ours is an aberration, not common. Or do our methods just suck? Have we just not been looking in the right way? Right? Are we like the drunk looking under the lamppost, not looking in the place where the answer is, but looking in the place where the light is better? Because we've developed a particular style of radio communication doesn't mean other people have as well. There may be styles of communication we haven't even thought of yet. If we're not looking in that, we're not going to find it. So the problem with SETI, the promise of SETI is if it finds something, it's awesome. If you don't find anything, it's very hard to interpret that failure. But that said, let's press onward. Why is it people even think SETI is reasonable? Part of this lies in the answer that we've already addressed a little bit, is the vast interstellar distances involved. In our own local solar neighborhood, the average distance between stars is about 6 light years. It would take the fastest spacecraft we possess nearly 100,000 years or more to traverse that distance. So it's pretty clear that if you want to send messages, you want to send something out into space, you want it to be light and cheap, and the best way to do that is talk. Talk is cheap. Basically, the messages you send using electromagnetic radiation travel at the speed of light, and they travel at very, very low energy cost. Right? If you're trying to move matter fast, and we'll talk about this when we talk about interstellar travel, it's fearsomely expensive. It takes the energy output and more of an entire technological civilization just to move a small payload at a tiny fraction of the speed of light. But I can make something move the speed of light easily if I'm using light. Light is small and cheap. The question is, what type of light should you use? After all, electromagnetic radiation, light, suffuses the galaxy, suffuses the universe. It's how we interact with the universe. We have very few artifacts from space. We have a handful of moon rocks, a couple of asteroid bits and meteors, a couple of bits knocked off the surface of Mars. That's it for physical pieces of the universe. Everything we know about our universe comes to us through studying electromagnetic radiation, through studying light that comes from various astronomical sources. So you have to be somewhat careful how you choose, because you have to choose forms of light that are not naturally occurring. You don't want to hide, obscure your position by using something that looks like something which is just a star or a nebula or a funky kind of neutron star. There are two basic wavelength regimes that have a great deal of promise. There are others, but these are the most promising technologically so far. The first is to use microwaves. These are frequencies between 1,000 and 10,000 megahertz. So we're getting out beyond the regular radio bands that we're used to thinking of. This is a region where there's very low cosmic background noise, cosmic background sources. There are lots of sources that emit at fairly low energies and a lot of sources that emit at fairly high energies. High energies meaning infrared and up through visible and ultraviolet. But there's a little gap that sits down in the microwave region where space is pretty quiet. Obviously, that's a good place to start. Go where there are not a lot of natural sources. The other place is you can go into a crowded part of the spectrum, like the visible and infrared light, which is very crowded by starlight, first and foremost. But create a form of light which is not naturally occurring, and that would be lasers. Lasers are devices that produce highly monochromatic beams of light that are highly coherent. Laser stands for light amplification through stimulated emission of radiation. They're terribly common today. So in fact, I can buy them. You know, a green laser pointer is now integrated into practically every remote mouse you can buy. This is an extremely narrowband form of light, and the light is all coherent. The waves all move together. They're all in phase, to use this technical term for this. This is relatively straightforward to build devices like this today. There's little diodes inside here that do this. But it turns out that naturally occurring visible and infrared lasers, well, we don't know of any yet. It's actually fairly hard to set up those conditions under conditions that you might find, say, in an interstellar gas cloud or in a star. We can do it at microwaves. Certain molecular lasers, or called masers, actually do exist, and they're used in astrophysics to study all kinds of objects. But visible and IR lasers, few if any natural laser sources have ever been discovered in space. So if you suddenly saw a green light laser spot coming from a place in space, it would really grab your attention, because it would be really hard to understand how you would set that up without some kind of artifice to do so. And therefore, it's probably of intelligent origin, especially if it's modulated and blinking on and off of bits of ones and zeros. Now, I'm not going to talk too much about this stuff. It's often referred to as optical SETI, because it's not a very mature topic right now. People are trying it, but it's real pie-in-the-sky stuff. I really want to concentrate on radio SETI, because that's where most of the action's gone. This is a kind of a complicated plot. It shows radio frequency in megahertz. So remember, the sort of background radio dial is about 100 megahertz or so. 105 megahertz is kind of the top of the FM radio band is down here. Television and other things kind of sit in here, as does microwave communications, things we communicate with satellites. But if you look at radiation coming from space, there's an awful lot of galactic radio background. There's naturally occurring sources of radio that have to do with accelerating electrons and magnetic fields. One thing the galaxy's got is a lot of electrons and a lot of magnetic fields. So those backgrounds get high. There's a lot of radio noise in that part of the spectrum. At high frequencies, shorter wavelengths, so you start heading up towards frequencies that are starting to get up into far into the microwaves and up into the far infrared and near infrared, you start picking up background which is due to the Earth's atmosphere and due to other naturally occurring sources. But there's this strong dip between the galactic background, the cosmic X-ray microwave background from the birth of the universe to various natural sources, where there's a very, very low amount of signal. It's kind of quiet back there. And it's bracketed in particular by strong emission from hydrogen atoms and from the hydroxyl radical, the OH. OH plus H makes water. So this particular region between about 1420 and 1640 megahertz is called the water hole. It has a number of reasons why you would look there. The first I've already mentioned is it's very quiet there. The second is anybody who is technologically advanced enough to want to study the galaxy in radio wavelengths will be using 1420 megahertz to map out where the hydrogen gas is, hydrogen atomic gas is in our galaxy. They will also be measuring out around 1640 megahertz because hydroxyl is one of those natural laser sources. Turns out that in the atmospheres of really big evolved stars, you can get conditions that can set up what's called a hydroxyl maser. And they're very useful for studying regions of relatively young star formation or stars near the end of their life. So anyone who's interested in those questions is mapping the galaxy in hydrogen and searching for hydroxyl masers. And so they would be naturally scanning or measuring in this frequency band. So if you were to slot a radio signal right in between those, where there are no naturally occurring emission sources, you would make your presence known. It also has an advantage, a practical advantage from the point of view of people doing SETI experiments on the Earth, is our radio telescopes are not surprisingly designed to work on mapping hydrogen in our galaxy and looking for hydroxyl lasers, masers. So this is a way of, I don't have to go out and develop any new receiver technology. I simply piggyback upon existing radio telescopes, which are designed to work in this beautiful band here. So it's a really natural place to look. And, of course, it's been rather jokingly referred to as the water hole, because it may be the electromagnetic gathering place of intelligent civilizations, just like a water hole in a desert is the gathering place of different species. So that's where we're going to look. So once we've decided where we're going to look, how do we look? The whole goal was developed in the 1960s and early 70s by really, it was Frank Drake and others of Drake equation fame who came up with this idea of searching in the water hole between about 1420 and 1640 megahertz for signals from extraterrestrial intelligences. And of course, Drake was to turn it around and actually begin to transmit in those areas as well. It's pretty cheap when you really consider it. All you need is a radio receiver. They've already been built for radio astronomy, so you simply just repurpose the radio telescope for a SETI search. In order to detect fainter and fainter sources from astronomical sources to study them in more detail, a large number of people have been pushing the technology to greater and greater sensitivity and discrimination in those receivers. So the technological development is being done for free, as it were, as far as SETI is concerned, and they themselves can contribute it. It also has another advantage. SETI is pretty way out there. But let's say you've got a SETI project and you're going to say, I'm going to make an improvement in the performance of a particular type of radio receiver that I'm interested in doing for SETI. Other radio astronomy that isn't interested in SETI, that's interested in studying the galaxy or other sources, will benefit from the newer technology. So you don't have to make a stretch for building a technology that's only useful for one thing. So it makes a lot of sense to do this. There are two basic strategies that have emerged. There are the targeted surveys, which use existing observing facilities or new dedicated facilities to search specifically for signals. So they actually strip down the radio telescope and they purpose build it for doing SETI work. And there's a small number of those. Jill Tarter at the SETI Institute has been one of the real pioneers of that. The other is the so-called piggyback survey, where you use existing radio telescopes, but you're not the primary instrument. You kind of pick up a little beam space on the telescope and use it on the side while the telescope is going off and doing whatever the astronomers are doing, studying gas clouds or OH masers. You just happen to sit there, and you're hoping to serendipitously watch wherever they're looking. You're part of the sky scanning. So this one, you would have a particular target list. For example, you might target all the Kepler stars that have planets. You might target any place where radio velocities or microlensing has found planets and say, hey, if we got planets, we'll look at those. And then you start doing a regular rotation of, say, all the G, K, and M stars in the local neighborhood. Piggyback, you're just looking for blind chance. You're just riding along with the radio telescope and getting what you can get. So here are some examples of these different surveys that people have actually tried. These are now in operation at various levels of participation. Every now and then, this stuff sounds sufficiently, well, out there enough that a Congress critter trying to basically make a name for themselves as being very good with the budget tries to slash one of these programs. Saves absolutely nothing by doing it. I mean, come on, your typical Congress critter will spend $1 million a year just on mail franking or something like that. So they save $1 million here, $1 million there. It just looks good to the folks back home, but doesn't really accomplish much by way of a $1 trillion deficit. But it happens anyway because it's politics. It's not supposed to make sense. So here's a project which has been going on for a number of years. This is one of these piggyback surveys called Serendip. They always have to have an acronym. This is the search for extraterrestrial radio emissions from nearby developed intelligent populations. They're trying to play on the word serendipity, meaning finding stuff, kind of just because you happen to be in the right place at the right time. UC Berkeley and Cornell are operating this because Cornell for a long time was the major builder and operator of the giant 1,000-foot Arecibo radio telescope down in Puerto Rico. This is a radio telescope that's built into a natural bowl valley in Puerto Rico. The radio dish is basically fixed on the Earth, and then there's a receiver. The receiver can be translated back and forth a little bit, so you get a little bit of steering capability, but you actually use the Earth's rotation to cause it to sweep across the sky. It's actually a very useful technique for doing a lot of different studies of galactic structure and things like that. So Arecibo is a very, very high-end research facility. And what they do is they simply put a receiver out there on top of the feed horn and just kind of piggyback along. As long as they're sweeping the sky, they're listening along. So they've done this for a number of years. They've just gotten in, they've been in operation now for close to a decade. And one of the innovations they brought to this, they're listening in the water hole, is they produce a huge amount of signal data digitized, but they have trouble getting enough computer space to analyze it. So they came up with, at Berkeley, they came up with a really slick idea a few years ago called SETI at Home. You download a screensaver program for your home PC. So when you're not using your PC and it goes to sleep and puts on the screensaver, instead of having flying toasters with the Microsoft logo on it, it will run the SETI at Home application, which will reach out on the network, download one of the data sets from the server, and actually do the Fourier signal analysis, and then send the result back. So it's kind of a virtual outsourcing of all the processing power, harnessing a few million unused PC cycles and sitting in people's living rooms to help do to catch up with some of the signal analysis. It's not really done a whole lot that as far as finding stuff, but it's actually been kind of cool. They found some interesting things, but nothing SETI-like. And it's still going on. You can still get the screensaver and download it and watch it. It's not very hypnotic after the first 5 minutes, but it's better than flying toasters with the Microsoft logo. So you can go to SETI at, look, Google SETI at Home, and you'll find this. The idea there, again, is you analyze, you're looking for some kind of artificial signal. It's not enough to just simply listen. You're not going to sit there with headphones on, a la Jodie Foster. You've actually got to do some analysis to recognize a signal. A second example, and this is an example of one of these targeted surveys, is called the Allen Telescope Array, or the ATA. This is operated by Jill Tarter and company at the SETI Institute, which operates out of Mountain View, California. It's up in Northern California on the edge of the Silicon Valley. The Allen in this case is Paul Allen, one of the founders of Microsoft. He's one of the Microsoft bazillionaires. He happens to be kind of a SETI fanatic, and he's actually donated a fair amount of money to this, not as much as he's possible of donating, but he's donated enough to actually build and sort of keep the center going and get it started. It's a targeted survey in that they're going to go through a target list where they're going to go in rotation and look at a series of nearby stars. For example, they're already starting to target the Kepler stars that have found planets around them. They're studying nearby G and K stars, and they're developing a strategy of kind of looking where you might expect there to be planets, and you're kind of hoping that maybe one of them's radiating. The goal is shown in this. This is not a photograph. This is a computer graphic of the ultimate array. It's what's called a distributed array of little tiny antennae. It was originally intended to be done on the cheap by using basically like satellite ground stations, sort of a big amp. You know, nowadays we have those little tiny ones for like DirecTV and things like that. But you might remember the days of old satellite dishes. You might have seen them out in rural areas. It didn't have much cable penetration. You know, a couple meter across dishes. The idea was you'd use these cheap mass-produced antennae and then specialized receivers to build your array up. And then you'd build a big telescope out of lots and lots of little units. It's a technique that's been used a lot in radio astronomy to do certain types of radio work. Of course, what they found out is that it's one thing to do something out of cheap stuff. It's another thing to make the cheap stuff work reliably night after night. So the original plan to quickly be online with 350 antennas has so far only managed 42. It's actually a lot more expensive to build cheap sometimes than you expect. They've also had some troubles with funding. Paul Allen's been generous, but he hasn't funded the whole thing. They had some money from the state of California. In case any of you haven't been paying attention to the news, the state of California is in even worse shape than the rest of the country right now economically. Their funding was cut for a while through UC Berkeley and then restored a little bit. So they're kind of working on a shoestring. So they're just starting to get themselves into operation now. One of the things that they've done is they're also starting to play this crowdsourcing game. So they've got a recently set up a website called SETIlive.org. How many of you ever heard of the Galaxy Zoo? Yeah, probably not. It's not had much penetration out beyond certain sort of the geek core of people. What Galaxy Zoo was, it took the pictures of galaxies taken with the Sloan Digital Sky Survey and set them out on a website where people could join the group and actually go through a process of training themselves in how you visually classify the shapes and types of galaxies. And then you would go through and have lots of different enthusiasts and amateur astronomers classify the galaxies, contrast and compare, and build up a way of doing what would normally take one person a million years to go through a million galaxies. A million people could go through in about a year. It's kind of a cool idea. And it actually worked out, had some interesting results. So what they're thinking about with SETIlive.org is they will show you what's called a cascade plot. It's kind of a radio frequency time spectrum of a snapshot of the sky, but then have human beings do the analysis by looking at them and looking for certain patterns that would then tag those as, this might be something interesting for follow-up. Now, you would not know what the follow-up is. You would just say, interesting, not, according to some criteria. And so, again, the idea is you can get thousands of people with time on their hands to kind of look through this. Algorithms for analyzing pattern matching in radio cascade spectra is actually a phenomenally sophisticated programming problem. Getting a computer program that can go in here and recognize objects is actually really hard. People have been working on it for 30, 40 years without much success. Facial recognition software is pretty new. Human beings do it automatically at birth. Right? We possess extremely sophisticated pattern matching and pattern recognition algorithms built in our head and assembled, well, basically by unskilled labor. So it's very easy to have people trained to look for these. So they're going to give that a try. So anyone's kind of curious as to what this is about, the site's just been up in the last few months. It's worth taking a look at. So these are two different strategies. There's a lot of others that you might have heard of, Project Phoenix and things like that. This gives you the basic idea of what you're doing. The question is, what is it that Serendip and the Allen Array are going to be looking for? If you were to go out and grab one of the SETIlive.org training sets, what would you be looking for? What would you see? Well, what you're doing, all of these have something in common. Even though their technologies are different, the basic goal is the same. They're looking for a signal that appears to be artificial in origin, that does not look like naturally occurring radio sources. What are those characteristics that make something, I want to say artificial because I didn't want to say it's an unnatural radio source. That sounds really strange. So what does, in fact, an artificial origin look like? Well, one of the things it has is a very narrow bandwidth. That means it only transmits under a very, very narrow range of frequencies. Now, most radio sources in the universe are broadband. They don't produce very narrow frequency emission. There are exceptions to that. Hydrogen atoms produce very narrow emission at 1421 megahertz. Hydroxyl masers produce very, very narrow emission at 1640 megahertz. That's what defines the gap. But other than these unusual emission line and maser sources, everything else is really a broadband source. So it turns out that if you had a bandwidth of less than 300 hertz, it's not very broad in radio terms, that would sort of signal itself as being kind of unusual. And the thing is, remember, the universe is made of hydrogen, helium, and elements we're used to here on Earth. So we can, in the laboratory, predict very accurately what all the naturally occurring narrowband sources should be. What you want to do is you want to transmit a narrowband source where basically atomic and molecular physics says, ain't nothing here, shouldn't be anything here. And that's a way of making yourself stand out. The other thing you can do is you can pulse the signal. Instead of simply shining at a constant light, you want to pulse it in a way. Now, there are pulsating sources in the sky. They're super highly regular. They tick more accurately than any clock that we know of. So what you do is you pulse it in ways that are not naturally occurring, that maybe have a pattern to it, and the pattern repeats in a certain way, on and off. You also want sources that have very little frequency drift. Things in space move. They're going to change their frequencies due to Doppler effect. There are also things that change frequencies for other reasons. For example, a rapidly rotating neutron star is a very broadband radio source, but it's very strongly pulsed. When the first so-called pulsars were seen in the 1960s, the astronomers who discovered them at Cambridge, England, jokingly called them LGMs, for little green men. But it was pretty clear right away that the frequency of pulsation drifted. Why? Because it was a rapidly spinning neutron star that was losing energy and spinning more slowly. So that produced an example of frequency drift. Similarly, you get frequency drift from other things. So small frequency drift might be a sign of an artificial source. Here's an example. This is one of these cascade plots. What a cascade plot shows, the reason why it's called a cascade or waterfall plot, is each line of this digital image is a radio frequency spectrum. So I go from low frequency to high frequency in a very, very narrow band from left to right. And I measure that frequency at one time, then I measure another, and I kind of stack them up, and then I let them kind of fall down so that I'm like pushing on top of a stack, the bottom one falls off. So the oldest measurement's here, the most recent measurement is up on top. When the new measurement comes in, it pushes the stack down and pushes the bottom measurement off the bottom. And what you would see is kind of this cascading downward. Think of the kind of fancy computer graphic from the movie The Matrix, where the letters are all streaming downwards in a waterfall cascade. This is a very common way of looking at, of visualizing, complex radio frequency data. We do this all the time for studying ionospheres and for studying astronomical sources because you can see patterns in these frequency time domain that are things like radio whistlers, certain types of cyclotron and synchrotron emission leave very characteristic signatures, natural signatures in these kind of plots. Now here's one of these signals. It's extremely narrow band. It's got a very small frequency drift due to it. And it occurs at a place where there are no natural occurring sources. It is extraterrestrial in origin in the sense that it is not a radio source on the Earth, but it is a human-made source. It is, in fact, a narrowband transmitter on board the Pioneer 10 spacecraft. The small frequency drift you actually see here is due to the fact that Pioneer and the Earth are moving at different speeds with respect to each other, and you're seeing essentially the Doppler shift due to a combination of the rotation of the Earth and the motion of the Earth in its orbit. This was picked up by a SETI-type radio receiver for Project Phoenix. Of course, they immediately flagged this as an artificial signal. It was, but then they correlated it with the known list of all transmitting spacecraft, and they basically discovered Pioneer 10. And this is one of the ways they test their receiver technology. They know where these spacecraft are. They go ask the Jet Propulsion Lab, and then they point their receivers, and they train some of their receivers on these and say, can I find an artificial source? So because of these deep space probes, we have artificial sources out there we can use to test our techniques on. So what you'd be looking for is something that kind of stands out like that. You would also expect it to repeat. You would expect it to continually transmit. If you just say, hey, and then never come back, someone gets your attention, you wait for it to repeat. Where did that come from? Did you hear it? I didn't. No one knows. So if you want to make your presence known, you don't want to go around going, hey, and walk away. You want to repeat the signal over and over again. Here's an example of an extraterrestrial signal in origin. This was 1977 in August of that year. There used to be a SETI project that was conducted by the Ohio State University, actually not through the astronomy department, but through the engineering department. Joe Krause and company had a giant radio telescope, which was originally designed for ionospheric studies and also for some astronomical mapping studies called the Big Ear. It lived on a big field out in Delaware, Ohio. Any of you been up to the Perkins Observatory up near Delaware? Yeah, just behind Perkins up until about 1998, this huge field back there, which is now covered by tract homes and a big box shopping mall of some kind, and a golf course. Actually, it's covered by a golf course and luxury homes by the golf course, was in fact a very large radio antenna built during the 1960s called the Big Ear. It was a funny kind of fixed installation device down here. Well, they kind of ran out of their original projects to work on, so they started to work on a SETI-type project, just letting the Earth kind of sweep by looking for astronomical sources. This is kind of a cascade plot, but the cascade plot, this is 1970, so it's not on a CRT, it's on a line printer that goes ka-chunk, 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 bzz, you know, bzz, like that, every couple minutes would produce, or every few seconds, would produce a line in which the signal, the frequency bin, is going in from left to right, and then it would print a number, 0 through 9, blank for no signal or noise signal, and then to extend the range A, B, C, D, E, F up through Z. So you would get a number which would go like blank, 1, 2, 3, 4, 9, A, B, C, D up to Z. And sure enough, in this time sequence, all of a sudden, looking at the printout the next day, Jerry Amon, who was one of the volunteers in this project, noticed that for the 72-second, roughly, period, the signal suddenly went crazy. Remember, the signal tops out at Z, that's Q and U. And he circled it with red ink and wrote, wow, next to it. And so this has now entered SETI lore as the wow signal. It lasted for 72 seconds. It was extremely high significance. The way in which it swept through the radio antenna array was pretty clearly from the two feed horns that it was of extraterrestrial origin, meaning it was not a terrestrial source. It was not some kid with a walkie-talkie down the road. It was actually something sweeping past on the sky. But it was never seen again. They knew roughly where the antenna was, obviously looking at a huge swath. They don't have super good localization. People have looked at the wow zone, the wow place in the sky. Nothing. It occurred at around 1420 megahertz. So these guys were looking in the water hole where it was. To my mind, this is probably explainable as a probably human-made signal. It probably has something to do perhaps with signals originating from Earth orbit. You can imagine there's lots of places where you get glints and things like that as a spacecraft tumbles by that just happen to be in the right place at the right time to catch it. Lots of things flash and go away. It does not really seem to have any of the hallmarks you would expect of an extraterrestrial signal beyond being very narrow band and obviously of unnatural origin, artificial origin. The problem is we just don't know what the artificer is. The fact that it is never repeated makes it seem like chance. There are lots of what are called transient events in astronomy. So to my mind, this is one of the biggest red herrings in addition to red ink in SETI. It's been a distraction. It shows you sort of what an extraterrestrial signal might look like, but we expect them to repeat. We expect them to have some coherence to them. You know, this could be virtually anything. The fact that it lasted for 72 seconds and never came back doesn't help. So what do we expect to listen to? Well, we can also send messages outwards. The Earth, is, in fact, is already on the air as far as the universe is concerned. We've been radiating radio information for at least the last 80 years, in fact, at a low level for almost 100 years. Radio broadcast throughout the world since the 1920s. We've had television, which is fairly high-frequency stuff, since the 1940s with a lot more complex information encoded than simply sound. Right now, with the technologies that we possess here on the Earth, if we actually were on a star 30, 40, 50 light years away from the Earth, we would be able to detect and decode these signals. They'd be noisy, they'd be faint and weak, but our radio receiver technology is perfectly capable of receiving that out to many thousands of light years. Now, of course, there's a couple questions involved. Do we want other people listening to our radio broadcasts, our sitcoms? Do we really want them watching Jersey Shore? Probably not. It doesn't tell them great things about us. This cartoon shows a map of nearby stars and the various events that are out in the size of what's called the radiosphere. So, for example, the very first baseball game for TV, and the first time the president gave a speech on TV is out here. World War II, that would be Franklin Roosevelt. World War II, occurs here. So, for example, that's probably not something we want people to know about. And we go through here, Gilligan's Island sitting in the middle of there, the Munster. So, you know, our television broadcasts have been going out to the sky. So this is something we might go looking for. But it's, I want to sort of make a point here that this is only a start. This is a model of our galaxy based on looking at other galaxies and measurements of our galaxy in that hydrogen line, by the way, near the waterhole, center of our galaxy. And we're out here 26,000 light years away from the center. And if I zoom in, that's our radiosphere. It's only 200 light years across. So, yes, we're broadcasting like mad, but we've barely gotten started as far as the vast gulf of the Milky Way is concerned. Perhaps someone over here is listening. It's going to take a very long time before they hear the faintest echoes of our transmissions. So while you can make an awful lot of this, we're barely getting out of the neighborhood in this particular bit of noise. The other fact is, the Earth has been getting brighter in radio, but the rate at which radio brightness of the Earth has been growing has begun to fall off since about the 1960s. So down here is 1940. You see the U.S. is the solid line. The dash is worldwide radio communications. You can see a big jump here all of a sudden during basically military communications during the Second World War. And then in the post-war period, the jump in growth in radio transmission grew very dramatically with growth in technology, post-war prosperity, the spread of electronics, and so forth. But you'll notice after this explosive period of growth from the end of the Second World War to the 1960s, it suddenly starts flattening out. Why is that? A couple of reasons. Cable TV. We're no longer broadcasting cable for the most part. We're pushing it down closed wire circuits. Directed communication. Many of you may have internet in your home that's actually coming to you by fiber optics rather than Wi-Fi. Beaming. You know, it takes an awful lot of energy to send radio in all directions. Why not use a tight, narrow beam? You have to use less energy. And you don't interfere with someone talking to a satellite over there if you're trying to talk to a satellite over here and vice versa. So narrow beam communication, it's a big deal. It makes, you know, when you get hundreds of satellites on orbit, it makes it possible. We've also found the ability to code the radio information. Used to be by wafting the amplitude up and down, AM, amplitude modulation, or by tweaking the frequencies back and forth in a small band, frequency modulation, or FM. What's happened recently? No more analog TV. We've gone to digital TV. Why? Because digital signals can be sent with error correction for far lower power, and it takes a lot of electricity to run a high power transmitter. I can send more information at lower power through a narrower band. That's cheaper, better, and it tails off my radio noise. You know, it might be that, in fact, we often equate advanced technology with radio emission. It might be that sufficiently advanced technologies, in fact, go radio quiet because it's expensive to broadcast. In fact, if a civilization wants to be found, it may have to deliberately say, we are here, because it's natural. You know, everyday commercial applications of radio may go silent because it's more energy efficient to do that. So that brings us to the Arecibo message. This is a way of saying in 1974, Frank Drake coded up a 1679-bit message. The grid, 1679 is two product of two prime numbers, 23 times 73. In which it coded this signal as ones and zeros and transmitted it out into the waterhole. When you unwrap these ones and zeros into a picture, like I describe in homework number 5, you actually get a series of coded pictures. There's a coding of DNA. These are various ways of expressing the first few elements. There's binary numbers. Our numbering system is up there. A kind of a cartoon of a human being. A kind of a model of our solar system and a model of the Arecibo antenna. This is actually kind of a bugger to decode, so I've given you a somewhat simpler version of this to do for your homework. This message was not sent towards anywhere. It was actually just beamed towards the globular star cluster M13. It was just an experiment to do it, to see what would happen. People have tried this later, and so we actually have begun this process of how do we craft messages to go elsewhere. Some people have said, hey, are you sure that's such a good idea? You want to let people know we're here? they might want to come visit, and they might not be the people we want to come visit. There's a lot of reasons that we worry about sort of the fatal collisions that have occurred between civilizations. We'll say more about that on a subsequent day. Well, in addition to radio signals, we have also set out physical artifacts. There are four spacecraft leaving our solar system. A fifth, New Horizons, is on its way towards Pluto and will also leave the solar system, also carries with it an artifact. The Pioneer spacecraft carried an engraved gold plaque that showed a picture of a hydrogen molecule, directions to various pulsating neutron stars with a coding of what their signal rates are, so that localizes where we are in the galaxy. These things run for a long time. A cartoon of the spacecraft they just picked up, a model of our solar system showing the spacecraft was sent from the third planet, out past the giant gas planet, and a kind of a 1970s-style glyph of the people who sent it. Voyager went even crazier. They have coded on the front instructions, very similar. There's the pulsar pattern from Pioneer and the hydrogen atom. They've coded up instructions on how to build a record player. And on this record are actually sounds of people speaking, sounds of the planet, music, a little bit of Bach, a little bit of Jimi Hendrix. There's all kinds of stuff on here saying, this is who we are. We are human. These are our marks upon these spacecraft that we've sent out into the void. These spacecrafts are going nowhere in particular, but it's a very human thing to do. Turns out if you look carefully at every spacecraft that's ever been sent to any world, if you look carefully, you'll find where the engineers have maybe scribbled their initials or put them in various places, ways of marking, I'm human, I've been here. So we wonder if we're alone, we're also taking those first few steps of saying, well, we're here, this is who we are. Other ways of approaching how that comes about and what we might learn from that will be the subject of subsequent lectures.